Okay. Hi, good afternoon. Thank you all for coming for Grand Rounds this afternoon. I know we'll have people trickle in, but knowing how Dr. Moore can talk, I think we'll go ahead and get started so we don't... But really, no, I'm really delighted to have so many of you here because I don't know how many of you all know Dr. Moore. We see him every day. But Dr. Moore is here as the head of the Division of Surgical Critical Care and Acute Care Surgery. Today you're going to hear what acute care surgery is and that it's really, it's not something we thought of here at Methodist. It's actually part of an evolving national agenda item designed specifically to meet certain needs within our surgical community, which Fred will tell us about today. For those of you who don't know Fred, he's originally from Pennsylvania, went to Allegheny College, and then went to the University of Pittsburgh School of Medicine. After that, he went to take his training in general surgery at the University of Colorado, and that was in the mid-'80s. And at that time, that really was the place for trauma and critical care. It really was one of those places that kind of wrote the book on defining that discipline of surgical critical care and acute care surgery, or surgical critical care and trauma surgery at the time. It's a guy named Alden Harkin, who was chairman of that department there for a long time, not only an incredible clinical surgeon in this discipline, but also a surgical scientist. And there, along with his brother, Gene Moore, who some of you may know, who's an equally grand leader in this field, as is Fred, they really started an incredible clinical program in how do you take care of really, really bad injured patients there that really set the standard for the country and how to do this for a long time there. They also were part of an incredibly powerful scientific group that did really fundamentally important scientific work in the field of surgical of shock and resuscitation, fundamentally. So, and with that background, he actually was then recruited to Memorial Hermann, to the University of Texas, to run the Division of General Surgery, and most importantly, to run the program in trauma there. As part of that group, and not only did they become, I think, the number two busiest trauma program in the country, but additionally, without a doubt, one of the most important scientific groups in that realm, with a number of program project grants, training grants, and a number of things. Again, focused primarily on resuscitation, optimizing that process, as well as sort of looking at the fundamental role of the gut in all of those things that go bad in critically ill patients. So gut dysfunction as a mediator of sepsis and critical illness. But he's really a fabulous scientist, a wonderful clinician, and here, of course, has taken on this responsibility of building this new discipline in our hospital. So, Fred, I'm glad to have you here and look forward to your talk.
Thank you, Barbara. I certainly wouldn't be standing here today if it wasn't for your visionary leadership. In fact, I had invited Barbara over to a session to talk about acute care surgery, and she was the first senior surgeon I met in Houston who smiled when I started talking about the concept. So she coerced me to come over here, and the wonderful resources that exist here, I can't imagine that we're not going to make it fly. So I have been doing trauma, critical care, emergency surgery for 22 years. And I have no complaints about my career. But times have changed, and I want to sort of talk today about the crisis in U.S. healthcare from the patient's perspective. I want to talk about the crisis in trauma surgery from the provider's perspective, which will provide the rationale for a new vision of acute care surgery, and I'll talk about how that brewed at the national level, and then the opportunities that exist for this new discipline within the Methodist hospital system. So if you look at it from the patient's perspective, the system's broken. They're stuck in a worsening quagmire of trying to get access to safe and quality care. And we talk about safety. This really came to the forefront in this publication in 2001 from the Institute of Medicine, To Err is Human. And they talked about errors of commission, medical errors, failure to diagnose, doing the wrong thing. It's estimated this occurs one error per patient per day, and if you move into the intensive care unit where I work, it's twice as high. Conservative estimate, it kills 100,000 patients lives a year. It costs $27 billion. It's in the lay press. Here's June 2007, Fatal Hospital Mistakes, Reader's Digest. Lead story, night shift nightmare. 15-year-old boy bleeds to death after elective surgery. Why? No senior physician to see him as he slowly deteriorates. So the question is, do you think this could happen in your hospital? And if you say no, you really haven't been working late at night in your hospital, because all hospitals are dangerous places at 2 a.m. Now, how about evidence-based care? This has been quite a buzzword in our literature, and it was an issue in this particular book called Crossing the Quality Chasm, again published in 2001, Institute of Medicine. And here we're talking about errors of omission. You make the correct diagnosis, but you fail to provide the right care. This report, New England Journal of Medicine, 2003, looked at 439 quality indicators from 30 acute and chronic conditions in 19 metropolitan areas in the U.S., and 45% of the time, patients did not receive the care they were supposed to get. Hard to believe. So what's wrong? Well, it takes 10 to 15 years for us to take a proven therapy and make it standard of care. Our conventional CME really fails to change physician behavior. Now, when they talked about, in this IOM report, domains of quality, they talked about evidence, safety, evidence-based care, and customization. And customization is doing what the patient wants, not what we want. And when the IOM committee looked at these issues and they said, what are the hospitals and doctors going to do about this? And they realized that we are not going to fix it. So they proposed some external forces. For safety, we're going to have legislation, regulation like OSHA, and then we're going to leverage the payers and the patients to pick the providers who provide the best care. In 2001, these are the external forces that have emerged, and I don't have time to go through all of them, but their intent is to radically change the way we practice medicine, and I can guarantee you they don't care about the practicing physician. Now, how about access to care? Access to care, we've known about this for a long time, both doctors and patients, and it's only gotten worse. That is the subject of this report from IOM in 2006, Hospital-Based Emergency Care at the Breaking Point. And I read this with great interest. This was when I was making my transition to Methodist. After I sort of read the book, I went and got the executive summary and realized I should have just looked at that, because this is a wonderful display of what I experienced at Herman Hospital for 4 years, the last 4 years. Inefficient use of limited inpatient capacity, admission bottleneck, crowding in the ED, diversion, ER deaths. And I was so happy that I was going to come to Methodist and I would never have to worry about this again. Well, soon after I got here, I learned this word called Red Census Alert. And we're on Red Census Alert today. We're on ICU diversion. It's amazing, but the same thing's happening at Methodist Hospital, just in different patient populations. So that is the patient's dilemma. Now let's look at the trauma surgeon's dilemma. And as I said, I don't have complaints about my career, but if you asked the young surgeons today, they got a lot of complaints. And I think rode the crest of the wave of when trauma surgery was really in its prime. And I want to just give you a historic perspective. So this is Denver General Hospital. It's where I trained. It was a city hospital, a safety net. And around the time of the Vietnam War, dynamic surgeons came back to the United States, and they started setting up these things they called trauma centers. And they basically were knife and gun clubs. And when I think back, if you said, Fred, what do you remember? Well, I remember doing great cases. And I also remembered this guy, Ben Eisman. And Ben Eisman is like the Michael DeBakey of the Texas Medical Center. He was a gentleman who had tremendous ability to come up with novel observations and then do something about it. And he created this very engaging environment where, as a resident, I was doing great operations. I witnessed the birth of surgical critical care. And as Barbara alluded to, the research opportunities in this particular little city hospital were fabulous. Now, this just wasn't happening in Denver. This actually happened all throughout the United States, all these different city hospitals, these very dynamic individuals for what appeared to be a great public need developed these sort of centers. And what they did really is they captured the next generation's commitment to pursue this pseudo-specialist called trauma surgery. I mean, I always thought of myself as a trauma surgeon. So, you know, what happened? Well, in the 1980s were the heydays, and then in the 1990s, all of a sudden our society became less violent, so we didn't have all those knife and gunshot wounds. And then we were kind of like our own worst enemies. We developed a trauma center designation. This is the resource document that the Committee on Trauma updates every few years, and it makes like rules and regulations for how we're going to provide optimal patient care. Now, the problem is we made all these rules thinking about the patients, but we didn't really think about what impact it might have on us. So, for example, trauma surgeons will be present at trauma team activations. And any really experienced trauma surgeon knows, yeah, that's probably true. For time-sensitive decisions, complex patients, somebody who's seen it before is going to make a better decision. But it placed upon us an onerous in-house call responsibilities that nobody really thought about how to handle. And for years, when I was in Denver, the expectation is you're on call, the next day you're supposed to work a full day. Well, when I moved to Houston, we kind of changed that, and I allowed the people to go home. And then I got called in by my chairman asking, why were the trauma surgeons going home? Well, I said, they just worked 24 hours. Why would they have to work more? But that isn't something that most people even recognize, the amount of work that people do in the middle of the night. The second thing that was good for patient care is that trauma surgeons are responsible for the care of multi-system trauma. And that makes sense. There's a lot of different problems. Somebody's got to keep track of everything. But what's happened is that the subspecialists have really taken total advantage of us, and we've become the non-operative babysitters for the subspecialists. Regional trauma centers led to regional trauma centers. And this really changed the demographics. And this is just a quick overview. This is the Texas trauma system, started in 1992, divided the state into 23 trauma service areas. We're in trauma service area Q, and there's roughly 5 million people. And what's supposed to happen is all the severely injured patients are supposed to be funneled into these two trauma centers that not so conveniently sit on top of each other. Now, this is the data, this is the demographics of Herman Hospital for the first several years I was here. And what you see is a high percentage of blunt trauma and actually a low percentage of penetrating. Now, this is good because you can make money on these people because a lot of them have insurance. But again, in the theme that maybe we're our own worst enemies, we spent the last 20 years trying to figure out how not to operate on those patients. So now the standard of care is 83% of the time we don't operate on a splenic injury, and we have very good outcomes, only 2% failure rate. The same story is true with liver injuries. 85% of the time we're not operating. Now, they may have some failures, but the liver-related morbidity is actually very, very low. So this has created problems within our trainees. There have been a series of surveys, and they just only seem to get worse. This is the most recent one. Yeah, the residents find it intellectually challenging, some very interesting operations, most enjoyed their trauma rotations. But then when you start getting negative comments like fear of burnout, negative or non-operative nature of disease, no clear TURF, that meaning, you know, if you got a gunshot wound to the groin and there's an arterial injury, is that really the vascular surgeon or is that the trauma surgeon? If you got shot in the chest, are you supposed to call the cardiac surgeon? Does the trauma surgeon do that? And then finally, they're really not sure what a trauma surgeon is because there's no training path to it. It just seems like in some big academic trauma center, academic arenas, there are people running around calling themselves trauma surgeons. And then there's an issue that is disturbing because the young doctors really don't like our lifestyle. And after I turned 50, I didn't like our lifestyle. I mean, I can't stay up all night and then go work all day. And so we're not going to get anybody to go into this field if we don't make fundamental changes. Now, if you ask the trauma surgeons, they have some real positive things to say about their lives, but they also have some real negative things. And the bottom line is 35% do not believe that trauma is viable as it exists. So with that as a background, the trauma surgeons in the country recognize that the problem is soon there will be no one who's going to come and take trauma call. So this provides us the background information for why we would think about changing trauma surgery. And this really started with a presidential address of Ron Mayer, and he was the president of the American Association for the Surgery of Trauma. That's our academic organization. And his fundamental question is, who are we? And he challenged us to define our specialty, recapture the desirability. He proposed the formation of an ad hoc committee to define the future of trauma specialization. And then he suggested that we petition the American Board of Surgery for advisory council status, that is, to become a new specialty. And then in August 2003, David Hoyt, Wayne Meredith, David Hoyt is president of ASST, and Wayne Meredith is the head of the Committee on Trauma, developed a meeting in which they asked people from all these organizations. Dr. Bass actually represented the American Board of Surgery, and they had the goal of creating a vision. They then did form this subcommittee, and Jerry Jerkovich, a friend of mine, is the chairman, and the committee decided that we own trauma, burns, emergency surgery, and critical care, and we need to make a specialty of this. They wrote the American Board of Surgery a letter and said, you know, we want to become one of these advisory councils. And this is Frank Lewis's comments. Well, your request has led to a great deal of discussion. And he challenged Dr. Ron Mayer to come up with a process by which new specialties could be recognized by the American Board of Surgery. So he was the chairman, and so his challenge was to come up with this system, and then he handed it over to Dr. Bass to kind of push it through the system. Now, I haven't been on the American Board of Surgery, but they don't like to change things, so this must have been an interesting time. So the American Board Advisory Council status was awarded to three different groups: gastrointestinal surgery, transplantation surgery, surgical critical care, trauma, burns, and emergency surgery. And the anticipation is these will become standalone specialties in the future. Now, this is another trauma surgeon, Frank Lewis, who's the executive director of the American Board of Surgery. He came back to our group and he said, if you want to do this, here are nine things you got to do. You have to satisfy an unmet public need. You need to focus on disease management. It can't be about some special operation. You have to create a viable and attractive lifestyle. You must correct the present deficits of all this non-operative care and nighttime call. You must not trespass on other areas defended by other boards. You should merge with evolving specialties, specifically emergency medicine and medical hospitalists. Must incorporate the ACGME work hours and six core competencies, should focus on enhancing safety and quality, and should be financially viable and competing with other comparable specialties. So this ad hoc committee, they have gone out and they have completed a competency-based curriculum. They formulated fellowship training program requirements, and they started the process of verifying training sites. This will be a two-year program, be 9 months of surgical critical care, and then 15 months where they will learn advanced surgical skills that a trauma or acute care surgeon might need. For example, they'll rotate with Dr. Fisher, and they'll learn, you know, how you do a liver resection, because one day they may have to do that in a trauma patient who's bleeding to death. And they should have at least 12 months of trauma call. These are the beta test sites that have been identified, and we're at the top of the list. And then in 2005, the American Surgical Association decided they wanted to have some more discussion about what was the board talking about. and they formed this blue ribbon committee, and they basically came up with this diagram. And this is the proposed restructuring. There's several different cartoons, but there would be a core surgery, verify competence, then you would go into research, or you could go down and become a specialist in surgery, or you could come down and say, no, I really want to be a general surgeon. I'm going to work in the rural area, or I'm going to work in the city. Most likely, most trainees would go into one of these various subspecialties. Now, we have agreed to develop a collaborative program within the Texas Medical Center. We call it Texas Acute Care Surgery, or TACS, and we anticipate to have our first trainee start next July. That might be a little ambitious. So now I've talked about acute care surgery and why this is happening. Now I want to switch and talk a little bit about what opportunities do we see for this entity within the Methodist system. This is our division. We've been here a year, and in this year we have identified several areas that we think that we offer something to the institution and that we can take advantage and grow our practice. The first is surgical critical care. Leapfrog is pushing this concept of an intensivist-led multidisciplinary ICU team. Methodist has invested a lot of resources in this. I have created two different multidisciplinary teams in my time as being a surgeon, once in Denver and secondly at Houston. And I can tell you that this is the best way to take care of really sick patients and get the best outcomes. Emergency general surgery. We want to ensure rapid access for appropriate care. Many patients get stuck in the ED and it's just not quite sure who's going to take care of them. We want to develop best practices in general surgery, and then we want to start identifying additional areas of emergency surgery. And either we'll train ourselves to do this stuff, or we will facilitate it so that other subspecialties can get the job done in a timely fashion. Bedside procedure team, this is a concept that we developed in Denver in the early 1990s. And we did this because we couldn't get brain-injured patients into rehab because we couldn't get their open tracheostomy and gastrostomies done. So we started doing them at the bedside and found this to be a highly successful endeavor. Now, this team is really run by a PGY2 surgery resident, and the procedures that they do are very consistent with their skill level. And the residents, I've always found this to be a very fun group of procedures to do in a concentrated period of time. When I went to Harmon Hospital, we created this team. Actually, Rob Marvin, one of the surgeons here, was our fellow, and that was his project that year. And it turned out to be very successful. This is the log for a three-year period ending 2001. We did roughly 1,400 procedures in a little over 900 patients. And Rob did a very interesting study as part of our ongoing PI program. He wanted to look at the cost comparisons between doing them in the operating room versus doing them at bedside. So we took the blue plate special tracheostomy, gastrostomy. We looked at 20 that were done in the OR, 20 were done in the ICU, and we used the cost analysis system TSI, which is used at Herman, to look at cost data. This shows you that if you do it in the OR, we use 7 people. ICU, we use 5 people. I think this is the most dramatic thing. If you look at time, it takes 136 minutes to do these two simple procedures in the operating room, a third of the time to do them at bedside. And then when you look at cost, the cost is roughly half. You save $1,000 by doing the procedure at bedside. Now, this is our bedside procedure team in action in the Dunn ICU. We haven't seen a lot of activity in regards to this, but I believe that once people understand that this is really best for the patient, not to move them to an operating room, but bring the operating room to the patient. Now, one of the things that Dr. Bass didn't promise me was a trauma center. But she told us that we could probably make a good argument. And when I arrived, she and Dirk Sotsman had lined up a University of Houston business class to do an MBA class to do a business plan. And my job was to kind of you know, foster that enthusiasm. And there was a very energetic group of people who created a business plan. One of the first things we had to agree upon, it would not be located in this institution. It would be at one of the outlying hospitals. And we weren't trying to identify the best hospital. We were trying to identify the pros and cons for different locations and provide that to the senior management. We decided, we did show this was a critical community need. I've already shown you there's two level one trauma centers for 5 million people. You could probably have another three trauma centers in this area. This is an interesting study done by Rice University, published in 2004. They showed that both of the trauma centers work at near full capacity, both frequently go on divert, and when both go on divert, local mortality rises. Now, if you look at all the hospitals that exist in Houston, that's a pretty bad statement to say we're letting people die because we don't have the hospital capability to take care of them. Another study was done by Ben Taub, and they were interested in answering the question, what would happen if a bomb exploded in Houston? And they got data out of Israel to look at resources, and they showed that at Ben Taub, once you exceeded five patients, the ability to provide care drops off very quickly. When you get here, it's just not like, it's like not having a hospital. And what they learned in 9/11 again is that when you have one of these incidences, the walking wounded go to where they think they can get care. So what would happen in Houston is everybody would flood into the Texas Medical Center, and unless Ben Taub and Memorial Hermann had a fence around them and armed guards, they would be out of the picture. So their conclusion is we have grossly inadequate capacity to respond to a mass casualty incident. Now, the third thing that we had in our business plan is that this would be very consistent with the Methodist 2010 mission. And I don't know if you've all seen this cartoon, but basically what Methodist wants to be is the best of the best. And it certainly, I think, has a good chance of getting there. But when you think about trauma, it is the third leading cause of death. It's the leading cause of disability in our society. And not to have a trauma center in your portfolio, it's kind of hard to imagine how you could achieve this goal. The last thing we found was by a conservative estimate, this would be a break-even financial model. And that's the thing that maybe our class wasn't all that well versed in, was the finances of health. And where we are now is we have some external consultants who visited here in July, and they are focusing on the finances and the logistics, and I hope that we build a trauma center. Now, the next thing I want to talk about is evidence-based guidelines, and I already talked about how this is a big issue currently about should we apply these, how do we apply them. And my point is that the trauma community, we have embraced this concept for as long as we've been around. This is ATLS. It was published in 1980. It's in its seventh edition. And what is it? It's a cookbook. And this cookbook has saved many people's lives. The other thing that we do with trauma center designation is performance improvement. And trauma surgeons have been doing this for 20 years, and it's inherent to everything we do as a trauma center is to continually analyze and improve our performance. Now, this is Michael Rhodes. When he was president of EAST, he focused on evidence-based guidelines, and this is a very insightful presidential address. And one of the points he made, which I think most people fail to understand, is these evidence-based guidelines really need to be modified. You need to get the local doctors, and you need to take the guideline, and you have to get consensus. And now you have a local patient-specific protocol that you apply. And then this becomes the center of your performance improvement project: cost containment, education, research, and quality improvement. Now, with this little figure firmly imprinted in my mind, I went and became the medical director at Hermann Hospital. Now, when I arrived at Hermann Hospital, these were the people I inherited. And I would say there'd be some characteristics here. They're hardworking, they're intelligent, and they're very hard-headed. And so I kind of arrived there, kept talking about protocols, and they weren't really singing the same tune. But after a while, Dr. Red Duke really did jump on the bandwagon and came up with this quote. He said, "Fred, the wind blows hard enough, even an oak tree will bend." And so that's how we pursued this. There was we weren't going to let anybody weasel out on agreements and things. And we sat down with the subspecialists and said, "Come on, guys, we got to have a fair way of taking care of patients. We're happy to do our job. We need you to do your job." And we wrote this all down. It was all put on the hospital internet. And that's the way we functioned. We went to the emergency department, and we developed a tiered response in a collegial way with our emergency medicine colleagues. And then we said, you know, there's got to be one way of doing it. And so we set up standardized practices for how we evaluate and treat patients in the emergency department. And then we went to the ICU, and we developed a multidisciplinary ICU team that was run by protocols. And it probably took us about, I would say, a couple of years before people would really buy into this. But that is the way we ran the ICU. Now, one index of our ability to change things is looking at the total cost per case adjusted by case mix index. And when I was hired, we were here. Here was the expected benchmark. And over a short period of time, we reduced cost. Length of hospital stay dramatically reduced. And we have another number of examples of this. This is John Holcomb. He was one of our critical care fellows. And all the fellows sort of have to have a project. And his was looking at people with rib fractures and finding out if you were old, 45 isn't that old, but if you were over 45 and you had multiple rib fractures, you had a high risk of dying. And he set up a multidisciplinary rib fracture protocol. Dr. Todd was responsible for the follow-up collection data. And we showed that this decreased infectious morbidity and mortality and is an excellent example of performance improvement in action. Now, what proof do I have that we could do this at Methodist? When we arrived, the hospital was trying to implement this surviving sepsis guideline. And as I already explained, there's a lot of confusion on how you implement these things. And when they approached us, we said, "We're not too confused. This is what we do." And we went and we applied this surviving sepsis guideline. And these aren't my data. This is the hospital data. Mortality in the done ICU decreased significantly. I believe this is real. This is the CVICU that's had an ICU team for a long period of time. Dr. Faisal Masood has been leading the charge on this surviving sepsis campaign. And you can see the mortality for the medical ICU is still what was in the done ICU. And I predict it will come down with the arrival of Janice Zimmerman, who will similarly implement these guidelines. Now, the last thing I'm going to talk about is computerized decision support. And I had this great slide that was a pie in the sky. And I can't find it. But to some people, that's what this would seem. You know, you got to be kidding me. You're not going to be using computers to take care of patients. But yes, we are. This is a group of physicians, or two guys, one physician, one PhD, that I met when I moved to UT. And they were doing a computerized clinical decision support of mechanical ventilation of ARDS. And we were part of a multi-center trial. And this was happening. Bruce McKinley was the local PI, and they were randomizing patients to be treated by a computer or by my ICU team. So this is basically what happens. You have a patient on a ventilator. You get some patient-specific data. You put it into the computer. The computer says, gives an instruction. The RT with the MD consultant can either accept or decline. 95% of the time, they accept. And in this randomized trial, we showed that the CCDS was more consistent than my ICU team. So here, if you look at oxygenation, I think you'd agree that there's less variability. Now, these are the data that really caught my attention. This CCDS can control a very complex process of care. And what we were trying to do in that era was to treat people with ARDS with something called permissive hypercapnia and intentionally have their CO2 levels higher by using small tidal volumes. So the protocol did this. My ICU team didn't do this. And this is despite me going around telling everybody, use permissive hypercapnia. And it shows the problem with trying to change practices. Now, I recruited these two gentlemen who were part of that into my department, into my division, and we started doing this for shock resuscitation. And I don't really have a lot of time to go into this, but the way I perceive this is going to happen, here I am the domain expert, and here's my little consensus group, and these are all the papers and books in my office. And we're going to read all that stuff, and we'll put it through here. We get a knowledge base, and I'm going to give it to Matt. Matt's going to program it, and then we're going to go take care of patients. Well, it didn't work out to be quite like that. This is an overview. So patients who met very specific criteria had monitors placed, they had an oxygen delivery goal identified. If they didn't meet the goal, then they started going through a series of escalating interventions. And the one I'll highlight is this Starling curve, something we were all taught in medical school. But in fact, you'll try to find some actual data where people did Starling curves in humans, and you won't find it other than a paper that Bruce recently published. Now, this is the logic. Now, these little diagrams get kind of confusing, especially when you're sitting in a room drawing them, and who knows if they really work. So what you really need to do is you need to make the drawing, and then you take it to the bedside and try to do it. And that's what we did. We had formal testing with the computer, but we also used a paper protocol at bedside. So somebody would show up, a facilitator, and try to get the bedside nurse and the resident to follow the logic. And if it didn't make sense, then we changed the diagram. But over time, the diagram started working. And by 2000, we had a computerized protocol. We implemented in October, became real-time, bedside, and this is the way we resuscitated patients for about 6 years at Herman Hospital. This is the actual process. It's an iterative process. We evaluate and test at each step. It's never done. We're always modifying. We're always monitoring. And the real question is, why would we do this? You know, we did it for shock resuscitation. Bruce did it for ICP management. We're currently doing it for enteral feeding. We're going to do it for surviving sepsis. So why do we do it? Because it improves patient care. It's an excellent research opportunity. I would guess that we've written 20 papers in the last 4 years that have added a considerable amount of knowledge to how really sick trauma patients respond to resuscitative interventions. The question is why should Methodist Hospital do this? Well, it's going to solve a problem of information overload. And I challenge any of you to go to the ICU and just look and see what's happening. There's a whole bunch of people collecting data and putting it into Method, and then we're all sitting around trying to get the data out of Method, and then we spend a little bit of time making critical decisions. And the essence of this is the ICU team can't work any harder. If you just watch everybody, they're not sitting around drinking coffee. They're working pretty hard. And so what we need to do is really leverage emerging technology. And I think Joe told me, how many million dollars for Method? I mean, it's a tremendous amount of money that has been expended on this.
So about
$23 million. So we got to get something out of it. But we want to leverage this emerging technology. And what we're trying to do, and we're not moving along as fast as I would like, but they told me don't get nervous. But we'd like to take Method and develop a structured clinical document. We should be able to go in the ICU and push a button, and all the data pertaining to our patient should be represented in a way that we can read it. And then if we want to develop a special document, then we can, whether it's a coded document for billing purposes, dictations, going to optimize billing. We should have patient sign-out sheets, rounding lists, and that's going to improve patient safety. The other thing I want to make clear is this CDS, as I call it, computerized clinical decision support, all the components currently exist here. With Method, we should be able to get patient-specific data, CPOE, you know, it's coming at us. You can resist it. But this is what LeapFrog says we're going to do, so we're going to be doing it. And once CPOE is in, then there are medical logic modules that can be turned on in Method. And then you have real-time computerized clinical support. And then why would we do that? Well, we're going to do it because we're going to make money. That's what this whole pay-for-performance movement is. Do you really provide safe and evidence-based care, and can you document it? So I want to end with a couple quotes. Significant problems we face cannot be solved at the same level of thinking we were at when we created them. Albert Einstein. And then Peter Saffer, who's a very famous intensivist, the impossible is simply a greater challenge. And then I wanted to update for Barbara the horse situation. So my wife raises horses, and this baby was born a few years ago, 3 years ago, and has a very distinctive marking on its face, which I always like to end my talks with. And I wanted to show Barbara that it actually has gotten big, and it's been ridden, and you can come and ride it. And then in the background, there's another little baby. This was born this year. And all these horses have very different personalities. So the horse with a question mark on is like a dog. It follows you around. It wants to be petted. This thing is wild. I had last weekend go out and tackle it so that my wife could put a harness on it so she could walk around. The thing is crazed. But I'll stop with that. I thank you for your attention. Well, the problem is, if you build a trauma center, they'll go, because the problem is, and nobody really wants to talk about it, is that people die in this community because on Saturday night your daughter has a wreck, and Herman Hospital is overwhelmed. Ben Taub is overwhelmed.
That was my experience.
And you go into those environments. I was the medical director. We're doing the best we can, but we're not doing as good as we can because we're totally overwhelmed. And nobody really wants to, you know, go out and tell the public that, you know, that in this resource-rich environment, we actually have people dying. And as medical director of trauma to Herman, that was the most frustrating thing of my job, was to recognize that I couldn't fix that. This backlog in the ED was just not a fixable problem. Yes?
Fred, you said an interesting email to the department recently that I found fascinating. I was hoping you could expand on and comment for folks. It was that if central line infections would potentially not be reimbursed in the future if they were seen as preventable, how does computerized decision support and formalizing the way we take care of folks, blinds, for instance, potentially work in this in terms of saving money and, of course, in terms of getting reimbursed?
Well, as I said, these people that are running these external agencies like IHI, they take what would be considered maybe soft data, and then they say, no, it's the truth. So there's some data that comes out of Johns Hopkins, and they demonstrated that with a protocol that they could simply eliminate line sepsis. They then implemented it in Michigan, the state of Michigan, and they showed this same dramatic reduction. Now, whether that could totally eliminate Lyme sepsis isn't clear, but IHI got a hold of it and said Lyme sepsis is a preventable complication, and the way we're going to stop this from happening is not to pay people for Lyme sepsis. And I predict that when that happens, this hospital and we, the clinicians, are going to figure out how to make sure people don't get Lyme infections. And if it means developing specialized teams, that's all they do. And, I mean, one plan I was talking to Rob about, there should be an automatic DC on all PIC lines. I mean, we talked about on M&Ms, these PIC lines are hurting patients. Well, we should just have a standard rule. Day five, yank them, because we forget to yank them, and then they get Lyme sepsis or they clot off their veins. But, you know, until that's what these external forces are saying. And the way we get to the doctors is to get to their pocketbook. And the same goes with hospitals. And so I do believe that a lot of things are going to change in the future based upon this pay for performance and the necessity to provide very safe and evidence-based care. What I believe is that using computers will remind us to do the right thing. I mean, this surviving sepsis is such a good example of why you should computerize something. There's like 14 different things you're supposed to do. And how would the nurse practitioner in the middle of the night remember to do all 14 of those? And in what order? When we've talked to them and they've watched us do this, they get very frustrated because I think it was one of your patients, actually. You were in there, we were in there, and we're all barking orders. And they're trying to figure out, well, do they want us to draw blood? Do they want us to put a Foley catheter in? And now they want us to do a line and antibiotics. So somehow you got to streamline it and say, here's the priorities. We're going to do it in this order, and we're not going to forget to do something like draw blood culture. And I do believe we'll improve patient outcomes.
Yep. In your specialty of acute care on neurosurgery, so you know, how far into neurosurgery do you want your acute care surgeons to be able to go? Talking burr holes or emergency craniotomy?
Well, this is where at the national level it's kind of gotten into a lot of bad feelings, is that the neurosurgeons have interpreted this that we plan on becoming neurosurgeons. We don't really want to become neurosurgeons. We just want to make sure that neurosurgery gets done. So it really kind of depends upon the environment you're in. But there can be environments like in Boise, Idaho, where there is no neurosurgeon. Well, then it'd probably be reasonable to have an acute care surgeon that knew how to do a burr hole. And
they're just not on call.
Well, you know what's kind of interesting? When I was at Herman, the neurosurgeons there actually had a tremendous commitment to the head injured patients. But we had developed systems that really alleviated a lot of the stress for them. So they had like an army of PAs, and those PAs responded to the emergency department. The trauma attending worked with the PA to, you know, figure out what's going on with this head injury patient. We'd call the neurosurgeon if we really thought the patient needed an operation, say, come to the hospital. But otherwise, the patient got admitted to our service, and we managed the patient overnight. 7 a.m. in the morning, the neurosurgeon's critical care team took over, and we walked away. And that worked out best for everybody because the neurosurgeons don't want to come running in the middle of the night, and they don't have, you know, the expertise in-house to supervise the PAs. And so anyways, that's what I perceive is going to happen, is similar to the orthopedic problem we have. We have a tremendous problem with orthopedic surgeons not wanting to participate. And so patients come in, they have open fractures, and, you know, there's no reason in the world that a trauma surgeon can't learn how to wash out a fracture and put an X-fix on or splint the patient. And it really depends upon the environment and getting those groups of surgeons to work together. If I were to create a more ideal way of doing things, you would have a group of trauma practitioners, some of which would be orthopedic, some would be neurosurgeons, there would be face surgeons. And then you try to figure out how does the in-house person handle as much as they can. And then lifestyle's better because you don't need to have orthopedic surgeons run in the middle of the night to wash out fractures. But we're kind of far from that right now.
I like your model of having a trauma center decentralized from the medical center. I've always thought that in terms of especially a mass casualty, that it would be more than catastrophic if you had a mass casualty in the medical center. And so having it decentralized would create its own set of problems in terms of command and control, so to speak. But I think that the city is ready for that sort of decentralized trauma center. And I think you're right on the edge of where we ought to go with that.
Well, most of the city's in Texas are experiencing the same thing Houston is. Because of the unfavorable payer mix, everybody is getting out of trauma. And then you're left with these mega centers. So, you know, like in Dallas, they really got one trauma center called Parkland. There's something over in Fort Worth. It's not quite a Parkland. But Parkland is, you know, really a great hospital. But what happens if Parkland is taken out? You know, Dallas doesn't have anything. And the same goes on in San Antonio. The University Hospitals has grown into this mammoth trauma center. But what happens if it's taken out? Then there's not much. There's some Army hospitals, but they're not capable of taking care of large volumes of patients. So I think the argument for another trauma center is is pretty strong. Whether Methodist wants to go there is the question, and they'll have to decide that. And my job is to prod them along.
And the other is, you know, I did quite a bit of trauma in I was at Launchdol, so I did a lot of blunt and blast trauma. And there's really no way in the civilian world to get that kind of experience to see blast trauma in this country. So I think if you're at, you know, on a national level, if you're thinking about training acute care surgeons, they really should have some kind of exposure to blast trauma management.
So yeah, I had the fortune to be able to go to Launchdol also and spend a couple of weeks as a volunteer. I was pretty amazed by the injuries I saw. Well, I thank you for doing that. I mean, the service that people are doing over there for the soldiers is an overwhelming thing to see. There's a lot of work that's being done to keep those kids alive, but the injuries are devastating. One of the things we have is an affiliation with San Antonio. So I do research with a gentleman named John Holcomb. And what we figured out, actually, the civilian equivalent to a blast injury is a major pelvic fracture with mangled extremities. They act very similar as far as, you know, resuscitation and how you have to respond. And that's been our interest in trying to figure out how to use those patients as a civilian model to learn how to take care of those patients. As far as blast injuries, I hope we don't see too many of those as we move along, but I guess we will. Thank you for your comments. Yes?
What is the official policy when you call 911 or somebody does with the ambulance service, the Houston Fire Department? Do they automatically go to Bentall or Herman?
Well, in their manuals, they have two level one trauma centers. When I first arrived in Houston, they had one, Bentall. And historically, there were lots of bad feelings that went on between Life Flight, Herman versus Bentall. That largely got erased. And then they take patients to the closest level one trauma center or to wherever the patient requests, if that seems to be in the patient's reasonable interest. They're not going to take somebody to Pauli Ryan that's, you know, nearly dead. But but if the two level one trauma centers didn't sit right next to each other, there's a rule that they can't drive by a level one trauma center. So if one was physically placed further away, they would need to go to the closest level one trauma center. And I keep having discussions with the people here. Memorial Hermann would love somebody to take some of this load off them. I don't believe there's going to be any. They're not going to be nervous about it at all, because what they have is a trauma center that's just overwhelmed all the time. And it eats up their resources, and that really impedes them from advancing the Memorial Hermann Hospital and the medical center into being a tertiary referral center, because it's just always overwhelmed with trauma patients. And so I don't think, and Bentall, they're not going to be resistant to it. Bentall really suffers under a different problem. The city government limits the amount of money. And so they stay open as much as they can financially afford, and then they close down. And you're not going to change the city government. The city government says, this is how much money we have, we're giving that much to trauma, and we're not going to give any more. They could open up LBJ as a level one trauma center, but that would expose them to tremendous financial obligations. Thank you very much.